you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. It's a week of documentaries. Critic Lael Lowenstein, Claudia Puig, and Peter Rayner review Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go for It, about the longtime actress, singer, and dancer. Rise Again, Tulsa and the Red Summer, looks at the Tulsa Massacre from 100 years ago. Plus the new documentary, The Sparks Brothers, which tells the largely unknown story about the Los Angeles-born musicians. I talk with director Edgar Wright about why he considers the brothers L.A. rock royalty. Right now, we're listening to their song, When Do I Get to Sing My Way? All this and more just ahead on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle this week. We have lots of films to discuss. And coming up later, my conversation with director Edgar Wright. He's best known for narrative films like Baby Driver and Shaun of the Dead, but he's just made his first documentary, which looks at the rock band Sparks. You might not have heard of the group, but they've been hugely influential. So stick around for my chat with filmmaker Edgar Wright. But first, let's get to the new releases of the week. Our critics this week are Claudia Puig, who's president of the LA Film Critics Association, Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, Lael Lowenstein, film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and finally, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We're going to start with Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go for It. It looks at the longstanding career of the singer, actress, and dancer. The film is directed by Miriam Perez Riera. And let me just quickly add that Moreno has been in the news. She first discounted the casting of light-skinned Latinos in the Heights, and now she's apologizing for her remarks. But on to the documentary. Claudia.
I did really enjoy this documentary. She's had a 70-plus year career. She's still going strong. It's kind of had a resurgence. It feels like a tribute to a national treasure that's overdue. And it's a testament to her vitality and integrity, as well as to her intelligence and wit and her slightly naughty sense of humor. She'll be 90 in December and, you know, doesn't seem to be in any way affected by age. The documentary is rich in archival clips, but mostly it's just rich in her and Moreno, who's, you know, just tons of fun. She's jovial. There's a little acerbic quality too. She's very honest. Maybe it's the fact that she has reached this, age and she can be more open, but it's very satisfying. It's revealing. It looks at her, you know, iconic trailblazing career, but also the highs and lows of her personal life. Her long relationship with Marlon Brando, which was really a problem, and resulted in a suicide attempt actually. But mostly what you walk away with, I think, is this kind of document about cultural and racial inequities on screen. And she's very open about the ethnic stereotyping and this, also the sexual harassment that she battled. Mm. She's in that rare EGOT status, and she's the first Latina to win an Oscar. And yet, you know, she was playing these, they basically cast her in anything that was like an exotic role, Native girls, whether it was Polynesian or Thai or Egyptian or Native American. And she used the same accent, she said, for all of them, and nobody cared because Nobody was really interested in verisimilitude.
And for those who don't remember, EGOT is Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Charles, what's your take on the documentary?
I enjoyed it. I agree with Claudia by and large. And it's strange to realize that, you know, Moreno, who is Hispanic or Latin, was playing Tuptim in The King and I, and any number of other in quotes, exotic ladies in all these films. My one criticism would be, although they have a lot of other talking heads and they're impressive talking heads, they've got Whoopi Goldberg and Norman Lear and Lin-Manuel Miranda, I think the documentary would have been even better if they had just sat there with her and the microphone, because she's such a charismatic figure that you are drawn to her, you want to listen to her, and you want to hear more of her stories and less about other people talking about her. She's her own best voice.
Leo?
That's all true. She is absolutely still very, very vibrant and charismatic, and she just holds the camera and knows how to play to the camera, especially when she's revealing one of many kind of shocking details from her life. I thought this was just a tremendous documentary, and it is a PBS American Masters piece, so that explains the quality, just how well shot, how well edited. But what stunned me about it was, you know, of course, I knew that Moreno was a great artist and the, you know, all the awards that she's won, but I didn't realize how incredibly wise and self-aware and circumspect she is. And, you know, she talks about this relationship with Marlon Brando and how it damaged her and how it changed her and how, you know, having to make herself a Latina Elizabeth Taylor, you know, when she first came to the studio system, how that affected her. And then not to mention dealing with Harry Cohn and the abuse at the hands of her agent, just all of this, you know, really, really stunning, revealing and very eye-opening look at an artist who, you know, we've all always respected.
You can see the documentary Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It, in select theaters, including various Lemley's theaters. It's rated PG-13. Next, Les Nôtres. It's a French-Canadian drama about a young girl who is pregnant. It stars Emily Bière. Peter, tell us about Les Nôtres.
This is a pretty terrific movie. It's set in a small Quebec community, very you know, insulated, and it's about 13-year-old Magali, played very well, played by Emily Bière, who is discovered early in the film to be pregnant. There was a construction site tragedy in the community, and a memorial park is being erected at the site at the start of the film. There's a kind of a dinner celebration of the construction presided over by the mayor of the town, Jean-Marc, who's played by Paul Doucet. Very good performance. Anyway, it develops that that he is the father of the child, and that Magali will not reveal who the father is, but it's revealed pretty early on, so I'm not giving anything away.
It's about 45 minutes in, so yeah, okay, I'll go with it.
Oh, well, I didn't want that. So the point of the film is that really, ultimately, nobody is there to protect her. Mm-hmm. Not her mother. Her father was killed in the tragedy. Nor the mayor, obviously, or his wife. They have adopted two Hispanic boys. One of whom is Magali's best friend, Manuel, and he's somewhat ostracized and suspected. And, you know, he's sort of the foreigner in this fairly racist community when you delve not far below the surface. So it's a kind of enveloping tragedy that has an inevitability to it. And even though we can sort of see where it's moving, that in some ways makes it even more harrowing. It's a really terrific piece of work.
Leon?
Oh, yeah, I liked it very much. I thought it was just very tautly directed and superbly acted. Having just seen Mayor of Easttown, it struck me there were certain similarities in that there's a very tight-knit community with a lot of deep secrets that you really don't know what's going on underneath the surface when you first see a place. Very, very well directed, very emotionally authentic, calibrated performances, and gave a really kind of very realistic and believable feeling of this small town and the angst that's felt throughout. I thought it was quite good.
Claudia?
Yeah, I echo what my colleagues have just said. It's an intriguing portrait of this cloistered small town. I thought that was, the idea that they're sort of, on the one hand, they would say that they're tightly knit and they look out for each other. They open up their homes to each other, but there's this malicious underbelly to this town, which, as Leo pointed out, is sort of similar to Mayor of Easttown. You know, they turn blind eyes to the truth in order to kind of keep themselves content and insular. And the mayor, of course, is this villainous figure. I thought Emily Bierre was really good. I also thought the boy who played Manu, Leon Pelletier, was also really good. You know, the racism of the other, these two Mexican adopted kids who, you know, suddenly everyone's perfectly happy to blame one of them rather than look to the person who they, you know, admire in this town. It's a really, really well acted, well directed story of child victimization.
Yeah, and I think it understands the point of view of teens incredibly well, very sensitive from that perspective. Le Note is directed by Jean LeBlanc. It is available at Lemley's Royal Theater and Lemley's Virtual Cinema. It is unrated. Next, Rise Again, Tulsa and the Red Summer. It's another of the many high-profile documentaries on the docket this week. Rise Again, Tulsa and the Red Summer is directed by Don Porter. It looks at the media's role following the two-day Tulsa massacre in 1921, just a little more than 100 years ago. It's an egregious moment in American history that a lot of folks are just now learning about. Lael, what's your take on this documentary?
Oh, I thought it was outstanding. It was so informative. And, Deneen Brown, who is a reporter with the Washington Post, reported, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago on sort of the developing story of trying, you know, what's happening with exhuming the bodies and what was developing with that. She is sort of our narrator and leads us through this film and on this journey to find out, you know, whether there will be restitution for these families, whether there will be restorative justice, and what exactly that means. Most importantly, this film put into context the Tulsa massacre by stating that it didn't happen in a vacuum, that there were events in that red summer that's mentioned in the title, the summer of 1919, where there were various riots and murders of Black people throughout the South and other areas, even in the Midwest. And that, you know, really sort of shows how that this atmosphere was fomenting the kind of racism that led to this tragedy. I thought it was excellent. It's National Geographic, so it should be.
Claudia, what's your take?
Yeah, the director, Don Porter, made last year's film, John Lewis, Good Trouble, about the congressman who passed away last year. And she also did The Way I See It, which chronicled Pete Souza, the White House photographer. She is a really good documentarian. She covers something that is very difficult. She structures it like she takes us on this historical journey, and she looks at the other cities in addition to Tulsa, which, you know, few of us, sadly enough, knew about the Tulsa massacre. But, you know, we learned about St. Louis and Omaha and Chicago and Elaine, Arkansas. And there were 26 at least cities that had massacres and riots in that red summer. And she's very effective in the way she has Deneen Brown kind of be our guide, and then also talks to people. There was an effort by the state to talk to survivors back in 1999. So she brings some of that archival footage in from this commission, and then the film opens with them breaking ground finally in 2020, you know, to exhume the mass graves and with the, you know, the hope of finding closure. She also covers the mayor, who's a little bit, she's very even-handed. She just sort of presents the information. This mayor doesn't seem like he's really, you know, cares to really bring much restorative justice. But she doesn't intentionally provoke this. She just kind of presents it and leaves it to the audience to sort of take these issues up. And, you know, the whole notion of, there's also an optimism, I think, running through it, which is, as terrible as this is, there's a sense of hope that even the title, Rise Again, that, you know, there will be equity and there will be some kind of reparation.
People might remember the riot is the opening scene of the series Watchmen. The film is Rise Again, Tulsa and the Red Summer. It has its premiere on National Geographic. You can also see it on Hulu starting this weekend. Next, Luca. It's the latest film from Disney and Pixar. Enrico Casarosa makes his feature directorial debut with this one. Jessica Andrews and Mike Jones are the co-writers. Charles, can you get us going on Luca?
Well, Casarosa was nominated for an Oscar in 2011 for his really charming short La Luna. And I went into this film with great hopes. And sadly, it's kind of B Pixar at best. The title character, Luca, is a sea creature who turns into a human when he is exposed to air on dry land. He's curious about the things that fall from the human world above. He meets Alberto, who lives in a ruined tower by himself with all sorts of stuff he's fished out of the sea. And you might wonder, how many wonders can one cavern hold? They decide they want to get a Vespa. And the best way to do this is to go to a nearby town and find a way to make enough money for it. And it starts to feel like a Vespa commercial in places. They meet up with the inevitably spunky butt-kicking heroine, Julia, and they enter a kind of triathlon that is bicycling, swimming, and pasta eating. They have to defeat the paper-thin bully of a villain. We've seen these characters before. We've seen this kind of story before. We've certainly seen this kind of heroine before. And while I give them points for trying things a little simpler and making some of the animation a little cartoonier in places, it's very, very talky. It's very familiar. And you're left wondering, well, how can the same studio have made Soul and Coco, and then at the same time, Toy Story 4 and Onward and Luca? And you could see one doing the three of them or the other doing the two, but there's kind of a disconnect.
We're going to hear more about Luca from our critics after this break. I'm John Horn in for Laurie Mennel. We'll be back with a lot more reviews in just a minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, subbing in for Larry Mantle this week. Let's get right back into reviewing the latest releases with our critics, Claudia Puig, Peter Rayner, Leo Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We were talking about Luca, the latest from Disney and Pixar. Charles was sharing his negative thoughts. Claudia, Leo, your thoughts.
Well, I found it kind of sweet and affecting. It is lovely to behold. It's visually pretty splendid, and it's a nice celebration of friendship. I will say it is lesser Pixar, but lesser Pixar is still better than a lot of other animation. I like the celebration of friendship. It feels like a nostalgic throwback to the 60s in Italy. The music is that, which is kind of nice. The Vespa, it's pretty beautifully crafted. It's not going to make you cry the way the best Pixar movies do. It might make you sigh in appreciation or make you want to go to Italy, particularly the Italian Riviera.
Of course, why not?
Who doesn't want to always go there? There's elements of like a preteen splash, I think, too. There's a pair of these are kind of like merboys. These are sea monsters that become human. It's got a slightly different digital style, and it seems softer. The kind of color palette is a little different. But I found it, moderately enjoyable.
Moderately enjoyable. That will not be on the poster. Lael, what's your take on Discount Pixar? It's come to be known right now.
Discount Pixar, yes. This did feel like sort of budget Pixar in a way. I agree with both Claudia and Charles. At best, it's an intermittently kind of enjoyable tale of these misfit sea monsters who, managed to find their way on land. But it did feel like there was so much recycled from, I don't know, Little Mermaid or Splash or any of those things. And there's even like a mean cat that is just cartoonishly mean and sort of ridiculously overdone. But I sort of struggled to find what was really unusual and recommendable about this, let's say. It is visually, yes, lovely to watch. But also there is a nice message about inclusivity. And if you were to translate that, let's say, to issues regarding trans kids and and acceptance and things like that. You could sort of find that message in there at the end. But it is B-list Pixar.
Okay. Luca is showing at the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood. It's also available to stream on Disney Plus. Next, The Sparks Brothers. It's another documentary. It looks at the lives of two LA-based musicians, brothers Ron and Russell Mayall. It is directed by Edgar Wright. Claudia, did you know anything about Sparks before watching this film?
I did, but I was a big K-Rock listener in the 80s.
That's a central point of thought.
Yes, and so I did. And I kind of thought they were British too. And there's a joke about there being the best British group to ever come out of America. I did not know they were from Santa Monica. That was revelatory. But yeah, there's a lot of their songs that even, you know, if you were listening to K-Rock in the 80s and 90s, you heard them, you know them without the fact that maybe you don't think you know them, or you might have attributed their songs to somebody else, because they influenced so many people, from Queen to Pet Shop Boys to Erasure to so many of the groups that, you know, that you heard on alternative stations like that.
Duran Duran, the list is long.
Definitely, who are featured. And that's what's really interesting in this. They have so many fans. They're kind of like the rock bands, the true rockers, icons. They're Russell and Ron Mayall. They're now in their 70s. They're still going strong. They're still kind of reinventing and challenging themselves. They have a lot of artistic integrity. And the fact that Edgar Wright, who made so many great movies, Shaun of the Dead, Scott Pilgrim, Baby Driver, the fact that he's a huge fan and he wants to share that appreciation with everyone really makes an impact, I think, here. He's such a gifted filmmaker, and he's made a really fun, creatively challenging movie that's worth seeing if you're a fan or not a fan. I mean, I was a moderate fan, but I found myself afterwards going back and listening to their songs and Googling and just, you know, wanting to know as much as I could, although I learned an awful lot from the documentary. It is 140 minutes, so you're going to learn a lot.
It's encyclopedic. Lael, what were
your
thoughts?
Yes,
completely agree. I thought it was a little bit long, but you know, then again, their career spans something like 50 years, which is quite remarkable. I did not know about the Sparks. I now think I might become obsessed with them because they're so fun. They had these just incredible album covers and these very catchy songs that, you know, you can't stop hearing. Their little earworms once you've seen the movie. I didn't realize they were a much bigger deal in the UK, but that makes sense. And this explains why Paul McCartney paid homage to them at one point. I thought the interviews were excellent. He shoots the interviews in black and white, using almost like the Interrotron kind of thing that Errol Morris developed. So you have these many people, including Duran Duran, Jane Wheaton, Patton Oswalt, directly addressing the camera, and you feel this sort of arresting kind of like closeness to the material. So I thought the Sparks Brothers themselves were quite excellent, and I thought it was a really good doc, just a little too long.
Okay. The Sparks Brothers is rated R. It is in theaters now, and you might want to stay tuned to hear some of their music, and I'll be in conversation with director Edgar Wright later this hour. That is coming up. Next, the documentary Sisters on Track is co-directed by Tona Greuther-Glyn and Corinne Vanderbosch. Peter, what's this film about?
Well, it's a documentary. It follows the Shepherd siblings, the three daughters, over a period of about 3 years. They came of age in and out of the media glare. Brooke, 9, Rayan, 11, and Ty, 12. In 2016, they had all medaled in the Junior Olympic Games and were featured on the cover of Sports Illustrated Kids magazine. They were interviewed on The View, but they were also homeless. They're a single mother, and they lived in shelters. And when word got out, Tyler Perry gifted them with two rent-free years in an apartment. And so it's inspirational in the best sense, because it's obviously a true story, and it doesn't sugarcoat the lives of these three girls. You know, they have difficulties both before and after their celebrity. In some ways, the main focus is the girls' track coach, Jean Bell, who is a lawyer who's been coaching the girls' athletics for over 30 years, and she founded a track club in Brooklyn She was raised in the projects, and she recruited the sisters from middle school to join the track club. And you know, she ultimately thinks of track and field as a way to you know, make it in life, you know, through college scholarships, you know, and she says, any girl I can help is a victory. So when, you know, one of the girls' grades slips or another is suspended for classroom insubordination, you know, Jean is caring, but she's also very clearly disappointed in them. She knows that they have bigger things in them than this. So, you know, this sounds sort of routine and sappy in some ways, but it's quite meaningful in the sense that it starts out as a kind of flashy success story and it turns into something much more than that.
Sisters on Track is available on Netflix starting next week on June 24th. It is rated PG. Next, Fatherhood. Kevin Hart plays a widowed new dad in our next film. Fatherhood also stars Alfre Woodard and Lil Rel Howery. It is co-written by Dana Stevens and Paul Weitz. Weitz is also the director. Lael?
This is sort of basically classic standard genre fare. So Kevin Hart's trying to expand his range a little bit here. This is more dramatic for him, but there are, of course, it being Kevin Hart, there are various jokes that you can kind of see coming as the dad who finds himself having just lost his wife, having to raise this brand new baby on his own, and is determined to, even though he himself is called a man child by his mother, he's determined to sort of carve his own way and prove that he can do it. It's sometimes it's kind of charming and heart tugging, and I'm sure being released for Father's Day, it will become an evergreen item that, you know, is seen for years to come. It's got its moments, but there are some things we've seen before.
Okay, Claudia, what's your take?
I was impressed that Kevin Hart is a pretty good dramatic actor. He's transitioned well from this kind of scowling, wisecracking comic presence to a more heartfelt actor. And there were moments that were quite touching. There's definitely a generic formulaic feeling about this movie, but there's also a sweetness and an emotional range. And I think, you know, the direction brings a little bit more to it, as does the presence of Alfre Woodard. It's sentimental. It's not outrightly sappy. There's a lot of heart involved, and it's based, of course, on this a true story. I thought it was, you know, well acted, and it was earnest. It felt like maybe it could be a TV series, like it could kick off a TV series.
Who knows? I do think maybe it will.
I do like Paul Weitz generally. I mean, it's not as good as About a Boy, which is one of my favorites of ever. But you know, he does bring a certain gravitas to it.
Fatherhood stars Kevin Hart. It's rated PG-13. It is available on Netflix. Next, Truman in Tennessee, An Intimate Conversation. It's another documentary. This one focuses on Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams and how their paths crossed. Lisa Imordino-Vreeland directed the film. Charles, can you tell us what this is about?
I would say this is kind of a workmanlike documentary. It's perfectly good. It's not extraordinary. Tennessee Williams, of course, one of the greatest American playwrights, and Truman Capote, both Southern. They were friends, though not lovers. Their paths crossed. There was both a friendship and a rivalry and a certain amount of bitchery there. And they've reassembled a lot of footage from old David Frost and Dick Cavett interviews with each writer. And there are letters that they exchanged or things that they wrote about each other that Zachary Quinto and Jim Parsons read as the characters. I don't know that there are a lot of revelations in this film. And I think they kind of soft pedal the self-caricature that Capote ultimately became as kind of a proto-Kardashian. interesting, but again, nothing... there wasn't a lot that I hadn't already known about these writers.
Peter?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have much interaction in real life beyond a certain point, and certainly not in the film. It's almost like two separate films about each of them. But, you know, it does position Williams as, you know, one of the great American writers, and at his best, you know, we forget Capote was as well, although he turned into a tremendous caricature, and you can see the progression of that persona in the film through the various interviews over time. It's very nostalgic and to see these interviews with David Frost and Dick Cavett, because you don't see much of that anymore on talk shows. I mean, thank God for Dick Cavett for all the great people he had on. At one point, Tennessee Williams tells David Frost, you know, I never got a good review after 1961. And Capote tells Dick Cavett, you know, about his novel Answered Prayers, you know, very beleaguered novel. He says, I refer to it as my posthumous novel. And Tennessee Williams has a story about how he says all of the movies that based on his plays, the endings were changed and cleaned up. And he says he recommends anybody who sees any films based on his plays to walk out before the, you know, 10 minutes before the film ends. But I wouldn't walk out after the last 10 minutes of the Streetcar Movie for sure.
Okay. Truman in Tennessee, An Intimate Conversation is available at Landmark's New Art Theater in West L.A. It is unrated. The drama Sweet Thing stars Lana Rockwell, Nico Rockwell, and Jabari Watkins. Lana and Nico Rockwell are the daughter and son of Alexandre Rockwell, who wrote and directed the film, and his wife, Karen Parsons, is also among the cast. Peter, tell us about the family affair that is called Sweet Thing.
Yeah, well, I think the family aspect works to the film's advantage, because the two siblings really do seem like siblings, which is not usually the case in movies. It's shot in very low budget, black and white. It's set in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Billy and Nico, the two children, live with their kindly but severely alcoholic father, well played by Will Patton. So they move to their mother, Patton's ex wife, and she's living with an abusive guy who has some very disturbing aspects to that with the boy. So they move on again. They hook up with an African-American kid named Malik, well played by Jabari Watkins, who's sort of a teen scamp. And they just sort of go, you know, rambling off together and have various adventures. The film draws rather consciously on Terry Malick movies, and also on Badlands, the music that he used in that, and Night of the Hunter, and so forth. But despite a lot of its derivations, I found that the connection between the two children was really quite strong and moving, and rang true.
Well, it better. They're siblings. Sweet Thing is unrated. It's showing at Lemley's Royal Theater on the west side of town and Lemley's Virtual Cinema. We have more reviews to come here on Film Week. I'm John Horn in this week for Larry Mantle, with critics Claudia Puig, Peter Rayner, Leo Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. We're reviewing the latest releases, and let's get right back to it. Critics joining me this week are Claudia Puig, Peter Rayner, Leo Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. Next up, the French drama Summer of 85. It's based on the novel Dance on My Grave by Aidan Chambers. Summer of 85 stars Félix Lefebvre, Benjamin Voisin. Leo, do you want to get us going on Summer of 85?
Sure. This is a coming-of-age film set in Normandy, obviously in the summer of 85. And it's a sort of not terrific François Ozon film, given the director himself, who's made some of my favorite films, like Swimming Pool and Time to Leave. This is a different type of thing here, the romance between a boy and another boy who he sort of fashions into his ideal friend, and then discovers that in fact things are not as he thought they would be. It's told in kind of flashback with a voiceover mixing different time periods, which is a little bit confusing at times. You're not sure exactly what's happening, but it's well acted. I just and the compositions of the images are strong. I just thought it was not perhaps the finest Ozon, given how I know he can make things that I like a lot more.
Peter?
Yeah, I mean, it's atmospheric. It's well made. It's recommendable. I think it doesn't quite add up to a full meal. It at its best, it sort of has a intimations of a cross between Call Me By Your Name and a Patricia Highsmith film. But I do think the actor who plays the sort of predatory sexual friend of one of the two boys, Benjamin Voisin, is the actor's name, was really terrific.
Claudia, what are your thoughts?
You know, I heard that Ozone had imagined this project as kind of an American-style coming-of-age story, a la Stand By Me, and I can kind of see that. In fact, there's even a River Phoenix quality to Félix Lefebvre's look, and Benjamin Voisin is actually quite good. It's all kind of predicated on the strength of their performances, and they're really good, and they do kind of capture the exhilaration of young love and, you know, that rush that you feel and all of that, and the sunniness, and the 80s are really well captured here too, with the Cure songs and Bananarama. And it's also shot in 60 millimeter to sort of better capture the period. So I enjoyed it. It was light. You know, there's an effort to kind of deepen it by one of the characters has an obsession with death, but it doesn't get very deep. It's still very sun dappled, and it's set in a beautiful place in Normandy. So it's genial.
Genial. Sun-dappled death. Yeah. Okay. We're talking about the French drama Summer of 85. It's from writer-director François Ozon. It's available at Lemley's Theaters, including the Playhouse 7 in Pasadena, the Royal Theater, and Town Center 5 as well. The film is unrated. Our next film is called Mighty Orphans. It has a star-filled cast, including Luke Wilson, Vanessa Shaw, and Wayne Knight. Robert Duvall and Martin Sheen are also among the cast of 12 Mighty Orphans. Ty Roberts directs. Lael, big cast? Big movie?
Big cast, small movie. this is, you know, in the genre of the inspirational sports movie, which I actually tend to fall for that usually. I some of those I really enjoy, as cliched as they may be. Luke Wilson plays a coach who comes to this Masonic orphanage, where he is tasked with trying to invigorate this group of teens and get them interested in the sport of football. Along the way, they make some innovations in football, which is sort of one of the more interesting aspects of the film, that this actually really happened. But there are some very, very cliched moments. Wayne Knight plays a super villain, kind of in, you know, doing his Newman from Seinfeld almost to the nth degree. It was okay.
It was okay. You're describing, I think, Hoosiers meets Remember the Titans with little Mighty Ducks and Bad News Bears thrown in. Peter, what's your take?
Yeah, 12 mighty orphans and 120 not so mighty cliches. I mean, if you had a computer program to devise a scenario for a inspirational sports movie that had every cliche from every one of these other movies, this is it.
Including the win one for the Gippers locker room speech.
I mean, I'm sure that's in here somewhere too. You know, it really, I mean, I am not a huge fan of inspirational, you know, movies, particularly when they, you know, inspired by a true story is the first credit you see on the screen, because I've seen it all before, and I wish they would do something a little bit different. Also, this has more overacting. I mean, it's not just, you know, scenery chewing, it's scenery strip mining. There's just so much of that. And by the way, if you're going to see this film to see Robert Duvall, he's in it for maybe 2 minutes. I don't even know if that qualifies as a cameo.
Cameo. The film is 12 Mighty Orphans. Lane Garrison, Kevin Meyer, and Ty Roberts are the co-screenwriters. It's based on the novel by Jim Dent. The film is in wide release in theaters. And finally, Crime on the Bayou is a documentary. It's directed by Nancy Bursky. Peter, real quick thoughts on this one.
Yeah, it's a good, straightforward documentary about an incident in 1966. Gary Duncan was falsely accused of violence against a white kid, and it was fought all the way to the Supreme Court. He refused to back down. Richard Sobel was a volunteer D.C. attorney who came to New Orleans, and ultimately he prevailed, and we have now the right to a jury trial and criminal prosecution that applies to state as well as federal cases. So it was an important case. It's a well-told documentary.
You can see A Crime on the Bayou at Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. The film is unrated. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you briefly about In the Heights. We're not going to talk about the casting. We're going to talk about the reception. Critics love this movie, had a lot of promotion, a lot of marketing, a lot of good word of mouth. It was supposed to open to maybe $20 million in its opening weekend. Instead, it did barely half of that. In fact, the Warner Brothers film actually lost the weekend race to A Quiet Place Part II. I think some people hope this could be, you know, the next Greatest Showman opens poorly and goes on to do really well. It doesn't feel like that at all. If you were to take a shot at why this movie is not connecting with audiences, what are your thoughts, Peter?
I don't know. This is just terrible news across the board. You can say that it's because it was also available, not theatrically, but I think, you know, as you mentioned elsewhere, John, that, you know, The Conjuring had a similar thing, and that did very good theatrical box office. I just think, you know, this is the first movie I saw in 16 months in the theater because I thought it would be, you know, up musical, but, it's the perfect film to re-enter the theatrical experience. And the fact that it didn't do well, I don't know if it's because of the content. I certainly hope not, I'm a little bit mystified.
Yeah, I am too. Lael or Claudia, any thoughts about why this film didn't connect with the audience? Because it really is unfortunate.
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate the fact that musicals are a tough sell. And, as much as I loved this movie, I've seen it 3 times, and it spoke to me as a Latina, you know, really strongly. And I just loved, as Peter said, the idea of celebration and re-entering the theatrical experience. Musicals are a tough sell, and especially ones that are 2 hours and 20 minutes long without stars. And, I think the movies that people are going back to see, and I'm not sure that everybody's, rushing back to go to theaters, A, and B, I think the movies that are being seen are horror movies and action movies, and this is not that.
True.
So I think you have to think about those aspects as well.
Lael, any last thoughts quickly?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think people were given no choice with A Quiet Place 2. They needed to see it in theaters, at least initially. And so that was a forced choice. I do think, however, that it will get legs. Hamilton, of course, had great pre-sell, cachet to it because of its place on Broadway. In the Heights, was a phenomenon, but not in the same way. I do think it will get momentum and people will see it. It's just going to take a little bit of time. And yes, musicals are a tough sell.
Yeah, I think we can all agree. We would encourage everybody who's listening, if you haven't seen In the Heights, go see it. And if you've seen it, go see it again. This is the kind of film that needs audience support. My thanks to critics Lael Lowenstein, Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, and Claudia Puig. Coming up, my conversation with Edgar Wright, who directs the new documentary The Sparks Brothers about the band Sparks, known as the best British band to ever come out of America. In fact, they're from LA. Stick with us for that conversation coming up next.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle this week, and so glad to have you with us. The joke about Sparks, if you've even heard of them, is that it's the best British band to come out of America. That confusion is why Edgar Wright, the director of Baby Driver and Shaun of the Dead, wanted to make his first documentary about the group, headed by brothers Ron and Russell Mail. Quite simply, Wright was tired of explaining who the band was and why he loves them. His documentary, called The Sparks Brothers, premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. I talked with Wright after its premiere there, and I started by asking him about his own connection to the band.
Well, I think in a way they were a bit of an ongoing riddle for me for a large portion of my life. I saw them first on TV when I was 5 years old. So I wouldn't necessarily, I liked music, but like, I'm not sure at 5 years old you would say, hey, I'm a music fan. But I would watch Top of the Pops every week, which was the big music show in the UK that, I think like a third of the country were watching it when it was on, when there used to be three channels. So I remember Sparks on Top of the Pops because they really stood out from the other acts. Because like, if you had another act that seemed like desperate to be liked, like ABBA, who were all smiles and like dancing and kind of like grinning their way through the performance. And Sparks are sort of a different proposition, slightly intimidating, especially Ron Mayall like staring down the camera at you. And I know for a lot of people, and the documentary proves this, is that the image of Sparks on TV at that time was something that really stuck with people and, you know, influenced a lot of artists. But I just thought, like, who are these guys on the TV who are, like, sort of beguiling and ever so slightly intimidating as well?
Frequently asked questions about Sparks. Who are Sparks?
We are Sparks.
What are Sparks?
Sparks are a band.
Are you a real band?
Next question.
Are you an English band?
We are not an English band.
Dude.
What do you play?
I'm the singer.
I'm not the singer.
Are you identical twins?
We are not identical twins.
How many Sparks albums are there?
There are 25 Sparks albums.
How many Sparks albums will there be?
With advances in medical technology, hopefully there will be 200 to 300 more Sparks albums.
You have always made narrative films. This is your first documentary. And first of all, I have to thank your editor, who must have made 10,000 cuts. I have no idea how many edits are in this film. It's mind-boggling. But when you are working in a documentary field and you are a visual storyteller and you have archival footage, at what point do you realize that you have to find out other ways to tell the story visually, using animation, using recreations, whatever it is? And how much of that was a creative challenge for you?
It wasn't a creative challenge as much as it was a gift. I mean, they had done a animated music video for their, not their last album, but the one prior to that. And they're obviously very visual. So animation seemed like a fun thing to do for interludes. And obviously, there are some bits where there are no photos and there is no footage. There's a great anecdote about Russell Mayall injuring himself during an early gig by throwing like a fairground mallet up in the air and it splitting his head open. Now, obviously, there's no footage of that. So it's like, that's an obvious kind of place for some animation. So that was really fun. I mean, we had this footage of a 1975 concert where there are a lot of young female stage invaders like clambering onto the stage and like pulling Russell Mayall down onto the floor or latching onto Ron. And, you know, we have an interview with Ron and Russell. We also, Tony Visconti, who mixed that concert, is also one of the interviewees. Nick Hayward, who's in the band Haircut 100, happened to be in the audience. And then through social media, we put the word out as soon as it was announced that we were doing it. I put the word out and so did Spark, saying, hey, we're making this documentary. If you have any footage or photos or even a story, contact this email. So we got a ton of stuff through that, things that Ron and Russell had never seen, things that like the sons of TV directors in Germany says, oh, my dad has this 35mm can from a Sparks thing he shot, hasn't been seen in like, you know, 50 years. Also, one of the women, now in her late 50s, who was the stage invader, got in touch, wrote this amazing kind of like email about her story. And I said to my producer, George Henkin, I said, we should get her to tell that story on camera, which we did. And so you've got this amazing thing. And
And she's in the footage. I mean, she's like 15 years old and she goes up and I think she hugs Ron as he's playing piano.
And then the roadie that pulls her off is Richard Coble, who happens to be one of the biggest tour managers in the world because he's the Rolling Stones tour manager now. That was his first ever gig as a roadie for Sparks. So then to put together this kind of like multi POV like sort of narrative on just one stage invasion one night, that was just like a gift, an absolute gift.
These are two guys who grew up in Los Angeles that went to UCLA. There's a great story about their mom driving them as younger kids to Las Vegas to see the Beatles. They're jokingly called the best British band that ever came out of America. And it's hard to place them in Los Angeles, but Los Angeles is clearly a big part of their lives.
You wouldn't think that Sparks were like kind of like surf bums, but in fact they were. Like in Pacific Palisades, lying on the beach surfing all day and listening to kind of like sort of pop music like all day. And they said that was extremely formative. I mean, the thing that's funny to me, and one of the things that I hope this documentary does, is that I feel like Sparks like deserve to be Los Angeles rock royalty. And the only thing that's been holding them back is people think that they're not from California, or they're like dumbfounded when they find out they are. I mean, even like when I first got in contact with them, you know, Sparks in my head were sort of these enigmatic geniuses that like, they were like the J.D. Salingers of rock. It's like, you don't hang out with Sparks for real. Like, I'm not even sure they're on planet Earth. But the first time I ever got in contact with them, I was in Los Angeles myself, writing Baby Driver, in fact. And I was in the office and I was playing my friend tons and tons of Sparks. We were on a bit of a Sparks marathon. Sort of the reason I made the documentary is so I wouldn't have to explain to my friends anymore how much I love Sparks. I could just have this film instead. And anyway, I thought, I wonder if Sparks are on Twitter. So I looked at Twitter. And I didn't follow Sparks. I found their account and it said, Sparks follows you. So I was like, oh my God. So I sent them a direct message and Russell responded immediately. And I was like, oh, most bands have like a PR person that handles their account. He goes, not us. So it's like, and then he's like, where are you? I said, I'm in Los Angeles. Like, we're in Los Angeles too. And it's at that moment, the world becomes much smaller. It's like, wait, these guys only are a 20-minute drive away from me right now. So within 24 hours, I was having breakfast with them in Beverly Hills.
Let me ask this last question. You love to use song cues in your films. I don't know, because I didn't go look. Have you ever used a Sparks song in any of your films?
No, and I'll tell you why. I tried to once. I tried to use a Sparks song, This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, probably their most famous song, in Hot Fuzz. But here's the thing I discovered, and this is why I think Sparks are not on many soundtracks. Sparks cannot be audio wallpaper. Like, the songs are sort of too epic and the lyrics are sort of too evocative. They're not easy songs to just have on in the background. So I found when I put it on this scene, it worked pretty well for a bit. But at a certain point, especially as a fan, I found myself listening to the song and not paying attention to what was going on in the scene. So if Sparks haven't been in my films, it's because Sparks cannot easily be ignored. But Sparks are not background music. Now we're trapped in.
My thanks to director Edgar Wright. His new documentary, The Sparks Brothers, is in theaters now. I'm John Horn. Larry Mantle is back next week.